Kepler. You're watching Global Investor on Business Day TV. I'm Stephen Gagnon. Stephen Schultz from Momentum Investments in studio to guide us through all this happening on global markets. And later in the show, we'll also be joined by Peter Hundersmark from Old Mutual Investment Group's Titan Boutique to discuss their global equity strategy. All that coming your way shortly. First, though, a quick look at what's been making the headlines. Well, Germany's largest lender, Deutsche Bank, has awarded its staff 2.3 billion euros in bonuses, quadrupling the payout from last year. This despite the bank posting a higher loss than previously expected at 735 million euros, marking the third consecutive annual loss for the company. The lender also warned of higher costs related to Brexit, but is appealing to investors to be patient while it tries to turn around its business. It expects 2018 revenues to improve. Britain's third biggest company, Unilever, will scrap its London corporate headquarters and make Rotterdam its sole legal home. Unilever launched a review of its dual-headed structure last year after fighting off a $143 billion takeover from Kraft Heinz, sparking a battle between Britain and the Netherlands. The group says the decision to end its 88 years of operating with two parent companies is not linked to Brexit, but that doesn't soften the blow to Prime Minister Theresa May's governments. And all eyes will be on the US Federal Reserve and the Bank of England as the two major central banks meet this week, with economists expecting the Bank of England to focus on inflation and the US Fed to respond to strong economic data with a rate hike. Here's more on that.
Central banks are flying the flag this week. The US Federal Reserve is expected to raise interest rates in response to a series of strong economic data readings. That's according to more than 100 economists polled by Reuters. And they expect two more hikes before the end of the year too. But forecasts for overall growth this year are still muted, underscoring a wide gap between how economists expect the economy to perform and what financial markets are actually pricing in.
The dual deficits in the States are becoming something of a concern, and there are some other pressure points in the economy, particularly the fact that wages are not growing as quickly as the bank might like.
The dollar had its best monthly run in February since 2016, as traders boost their expectations of Fed hikes. But after losing 10% in 2017, it's still down around 2% so far this year and is forecast to weaken further. And that might boost sterling. In focus this week too, as the Bank of England holds its next policy meeting. It's expected to raise rates in May, following a barrage of hawkish signals from policymakers. Most economists polled by Reuters don't see a follow-up move for another year.
If something happens in the Brexit negotiations that sort of comes out of left field, that might give the bank a cause for concern and put rates back on pause. But I think Mark Carney would ideally like to raise rates by 25 basis points at least once before the end of 2018 if he can get the opportunity.
Britain's economy has gone from leading its peers to lagging them since the country's decision to quit the EU. The British consumer is also in the spotlight this week, with inflation and retail sales data due.
Stephen Schultz from Momentum Investments joining me in studio. Let's start with the US Fed announcement, Stephen, because it looks like it's a foregone conclusion that we will have that rate hike in the US on Wednesday, 25 basis points. But I suppose everybody's looking at what the US Fed Chairman Jerome Powell is going to say in his commentary and the tone that he takes there.
Yeah, so absolutely, it's Fed week. There's a very high conviction. We'll see the interest rate increase come through on Wednesday. That's largely off the back of comments he's already made, so a fair conclusion. I don't think there's been a lot of data that's come in between his previous comments and the current, so no reason to believe that he'll hold back on increasing. But the truth is, what we're really looking at is the language used, whether he's got a particularly dogmatic tone, and whether he gives any sort of indication of four increases instead of three for the coming year, which I suspect is probably more realistic.
For the year? Because the markets at the moment is pricing in a 33% chance of four increases. Are you on that side?
Yeah, so look, I'm with Goldman Sachs on the four increases. I think we're seeing a nice inflation build-up in the economy. Inflation January year-on-year went up to 2.1%, so a little bit higher than they're comfortable with. We're seeing massive job growth come through. The economy is moving from strength to strength. Last year we saw 2.3%. This year we're expecting about 2.8%. So I think if there were ever a time for an increase in interest rates and they were looking for a reason, now's the right environment.
How will the market react if we do have those four increases this year rather than three?
Look, it's difficult to say. I think what the central bank, the Fed in particular, has been very successful historically, so over the last couple of years, is guiding the market. What the market does not like is surprises. That being said, I don't think Wednesday's decision on an increase is going to unsettle the market at all. They'll take it in a stride, and I'm hoping he starts laying the groundwork for a language that suggests four increases. As soon as it becomes a little bit higher conviction, I don't think there's anything unsettling about it.
To what extent do you think the U.S. trade tariffs and the looming trade war could throw a spanner in the works? Could that harm U.S. growth going forward?
Yeah, so Donald Trump's back at it again, antagonizing his international political peers on the trade tariff side. I suppose what he's initially suggesting is small fry money. It's certainly not going to derail any growth in the economy. What it does, however, represent is escalating a trade war with trading partners. We saw him suggesting a 25% import tariff imposed on steel and 10% aluminium.
Didn't he also mention fancy German cars?
Fancy German cars. He did give a little bit away in suggesting that Mexico and Canada could be exempt, but that would be on condition that they re-enter the North American trade agreement. So he's using it as a negotiation tool. China was very withheld. All they said was they would respond appropriately, which sounds like a trade war to me. And obviously Europe being a little bit more specific, claiming that they may slap their own tariffs on American orange juice and peanut butter.
So I was looking at some of the numbers, and the U.S. had a $566 billion deficit last year, and two-thirds of that was owing to China, so a $375 billion trade deficit with China. So do you think it's doing the right thing? It's within its rights to slap these tariffs on, particularly when it does run such a big gap?
Yeah, look, I think it would be particularly dangerous. So the one person that America would not want to start a trade war with is, of course, China, and those are ultimately the people they will be starting a trade war. I think that the risk in this situation is Donald Trump himself. He's got a very haphazard way of negotiating and politics. Whether he'll follow through with it, I can't see any benefit to doing so. I understand the protectionism side of mm-hmm. his aspirations, and certainly the leverage at a negotiation level. But following through with the trade tariffs, starting a trade war with China, I cannot see benefiting the U.S. in any way.
Okay, meanwhile, Europe has its own problems. We have this Italian election stalemate. What sort of risk does this pose to Europe, particularly with the Five Star Movement gaining such prominence within the Italian elections and the coalition that it may form?
Yeah, so just like that, the 4th of March elections are behind us, and we sit today with a significantly hung parliament, all three major parties failing to secure a majority, Five Star Movement being one of them, the other one being
Which
Northern
was
League.
Founded by a comedian.
Yeah, I suppose
one
of the real interesting things from the election is the fact that right-wing populist parties secured more than 50%. So Northern League and Five Star, the problem there is they are refusing to negotiate or enter into any form of coalition. I think what viewers can take from it is the psyche of Italian voters at the moment, clearly very unhappy, high unemployment, low wage growth, uncontrolled immigration, and a rejection of the European austerity.
Okay.
Europe's biggest risk, undeniably, at the moment, in that we're going to likely face weeks of arguments over coalitions, which I suspect ultimately will end with voters back at the polls. The real risk here is obviously the fact that Italy as an economy currently has debt to GDP in excess of 130%, much of which is owed to its European neighbors, and a disproportionately large banking system, which could certainly derail the current environment in Europe, which is very favorable.
Okay. Well, let's take a look at some company news and a deal that could be derailed. That was the merger between, or the tie between Broadcom and Qualcomm. And of course, we had President Donald Trump stepping in there and saying he didn't want the deal to go through. It was a hostile bid anyway, but it looks like Qualcomm's former chairman is trying to cobble together a coalition to buy the company.
Yeah, look, Donald Trump makes no shortage of news headlines. Look, I suppose this one may be for good reason. We've seen the hostile takeover being topic of discussion for weeks. The reality is Qualcomm is a Singaporean-based company, but more than half of its workforce being American citizens based in America. Donald Trump's anxiety here is, should the entities combine or a hostile takeover take place, what you'd find is a monopoly in the telecom space, and that would be at the control of China. So his big concerns there is China taking control of a key strategic interest.
Does the merger make sense to you?
Look, so from an economic perspective, absolutely. From a political perspective, I can understand why Donald Trump would not like to see the two entities combine.
Okay, Volkswagen is planning to have 16 factories within 4 years building battery electrics and hybrid cars and the like. So bad news for Tesla.
Look, it's bad news for Tesla, but I think good news for the industry. Volkswagen have potentially been a little bit slower than some of the competitors. Tesla's probably ahead of the pack. What we're seeing now is an announcement that they'll be setting up 16 production plants right across Germany, Europe, broader Europe, America, and China. We're expecting 3 million vehicles to come out of those factories over the next 5 to 7 years, which is a great development for the environment, I suppose. Another secondary beneficiary of this is, of course, the people who supply the batteries, and by that measure, extension Glencore, who have secured 500,000 tons of cobalt over the 7-year period, which is no small order.
Okay. And then staying in the motor industry, Renault has been rallying on reports that Nissan wants to merge with the company. And I suppose there's also country interests at stake here as well, because the French government owns a stake in Renault, doesn't it?
Absolutely. So at present, you've got the French government owning a 15% stake, and the total market cap of the company is about $35 billion, so not a significant stake by the French government standards. Mm-hmm. What is particularly important is the fact that these two counters have been operating in a strategic alliance since 1999, so I suppose it makes logical sense for the two to get closer. Nissan's looking to, or allegedly looking to, take the full 15% stake. And as a result, we saw Nissan was up single digits last week, and I think Renault was up about 13% on the news. So it's a great development for both the industry, and it's a great development for investors.
Okay, and within all this, the show that you'd be buying is Netflix, so you'd rather just sit back and watch some, stream some videos.
Yeah, so look, I suppose it is one we've spoken about previously. Since last being on the show, which was just over a year ago, discussing Netflix, the count has more than doubled. In fact, it's up 64% in US dollar terms so far this year.
So I hope people were listening to you a year ago then.
Yeah, look, it's been a phenomenal one. I suppose the real reason, it is the authority when it comes to global on-demand streaming television content. And entertainment, I suppose. It has a significant advantage in generating its own content, which obviously it ring fences and can only be accessed through Netflix. Mm-hmm. It currently has a penetration of about 17% of the 700 million viewers that are potential clients, and that's excluding China. So I think a great one to continue to grow.
Okay, so keep an eye on Netflix. We're going to a short break. When we return, we take a look at the Old Mutual Titan Global Equity Strategy. That's with Peter Handelsmark. Don't go anywhere. Welcome back. You're watching Global Investor. Still with me in studio, Stephen Schultz from Momentum Investments, joining us on the line from Cape Town to discuss the Old Mutual Titan Global Equity Strategy. His portfolio manager and co-founder, Peter Handelsmark. Peter, thanks very much for joining us. So if you buy the Titan Global Equity Strategy, what are you investing into?
Hi, Stephen. So Titan is a global equity building block. So for clients that would like, an active bottom-up global equity capability, that's what we provide.
And this is a dollar fund. Do you have a rand feeder fund that local investors can go into?
We do not yet, and we will be launching one very soon. So that will be turn the strategy we currently have into a local opportunity for investors to take advantage of.
Okay, good. You say in the commentary that you provide long-term capital growth by outperforming your benchmark, which is the MSCI All Country World Index, but you take less risk of capital loss. How do you do that? How do you kind of cut down that risk?
So that's a very good question. So I guess it brings us to a discussion around risk and at least how we define it. So in our maxim, we would say risk is the permanent loss of capital. So we would agree with Warren Buffett that says, remember rule number one, which is don't lose money, and then rule number two is don't forget rule number one. The way we think about that in the fund is we run concentrated portfolios. We put a lot of focus in our positions, so we're quite concentrated at our top 20 being between 60 and 70% of the fund. And we think that allows us that focus to build up the high conviction that we require for our position. So in terms of risk, we think your best defense against the vagaries of the market is a diversified, high-conviction portfolio of stocks that have a margin of safety. So we don't define risk as, for example, volatility like some others do.
How about concentration risk in that case then, Peter? Because you do have some big holdings. I was discussing with Stephen before the show that Facebook was under significant pressure today. And as one of your large holdings, that has to hurt.
No, it definitely does. I think it was down 6% before I got on the phone. So that does sting. Look, I think concentration is a philosophical argument. So for us, we believe the way that we value businesses, which is time intensive, really understanding that business as if it's, let's say the stock market shut down tomorrow. You know, we want to know what that business is worth. So we view it like a businessman would view it. That's the way we value it on long-term fundamentals. And that lends ourselves to making big, high-conviction calls. So coming back to the focus, I said as well, I'd rather focus on my top 20, which is two-thirds of my fund, and will define the future of the fund than trying to keep track of, you know, a myriad of different small positions in different sectors. So there's obviously risk and concentration, but we also see reward. There's two sides of that coin.
Where do you stand on that philosophy?
Yeah,
Stephen?
So perhaps staying with tech, it's going to be an interesting week. We weren't expecting Facebook, but Tencent's going to be releasing results during the course of this week. Just wondering on Peter's expectations for Tencent's results.
Look, for the quarter, I really wouldn't be able to make a comment. What we like about Tencent is, and I guess that's also something that they're moving away from, but the gaming remains a very strong part of that business. So, and we would all be aware of the penetration of smartphones in China, and we believe that still has some ways to go. And, for a Chinese citizen to get their phone, the first thing they're doing is they're either gambling or they're gaming, right? So this total addressable market for Tencent remains very big in our opinion. So we expect gaming to continue to be the driver in the results coming up. We also expect them to show that they are investing heavily in content. And I think the recent interview I read with Pony Ma was him saying that, you know, content is the future. So I expect to see some surprises there, and not all of them positive.
Speaking of positive surprises, I see you're significantly underweight resources at the moment. Would it be fair to say that that's a reflection on your view of resources, and we were talking about China in a moment, or would it rather be that IT and financials just appeal to you more in the current environment?
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. The latter would be correct. So we believe wholeheartedly in the disruption theme, and we do try to look for companies in that disrupting space rather than those being disrupted. But with commodities, you know, we still sit today, even as we did in 2007 and 2008, with the largest consumer of many of the main commodities. And when I say main commodities, I mean iron ore, coking coal, and energy, so oil, still being China. And, that's economy has taken a growth path which we believe we can take a view on, which is a path that has been followed by Taiwan, by South Korea, and by Japan back in the 70s. So it is, it is an economy we know will ultimately slow, and there is a predictable effect on commodities which will ensue. So it's a place where we are sufficiently skeptical and haven't found the margin of safety we require to invest in resource stocks.
Peter, maybe just going back again to Tencent, you don't actually have Tencent in your top holdings. You have Naspers, the South African company, instead, a 4.9% holding in that. Why go through Naspers rather than going directly into Tencent?
Yeah, that's also a good question. There are various companies around the world that are viewed as holding companies. So Pershing Square is one, SoftBank is another, Naspers is another. And these holding company stocks often trade with a varying amount of discount to their underlying holdings, especially if that underlying holding can also be bought by investors. So Tencent is a good example of that, right? I can go out and buy it, or I can buy it via a holding company. Why would I do so? Because there's a leakage. But now, I'm sure you also know about this, but the discount that Tencent is trading at within Naspers, which is close to 40% in the last time I checked, is something that's incredibly attractive to us, because over the long term, that type of discount really shouldn't exist. And then especially if I add on to that there are a couple very attractive businesses within Naspers that we value separately and we believe should be accretive to the share price rather than detracting from it, which is the current case. The flip argument of that is that some investors believe what Naspers is spending won't be recouped, but we take a different view on that and believe differently.
Do you take a view on that at all, Stephen?
Yeah, look, I must be honest, I can definitely see the attraction of going into a Naspers at the discount, but it is a very difficult one to call. One of the other counters that caught my attention was your stake in Axis Bank, an Indian bank. And I suppose, for obvious reasons, I think the market's whipped into a frenzy over U.S. banks. So it's quite uncommon to see an Indian bank in there, and by that measure, I think it's your third largest holding at over 5%. I wonder if you can just explain a little bit about Axis.
Sure. So Axis is the third largest private bank in India. And from a big picture perspective, the Indian economy is a place where we think there are quite a lot of opportunities, and one of them is financial services. So as a country formalizes, one of the big areas that needs to formalize with it is its banking sector, and Axis has been able to do so both on the institutional and the retail side. So Axis is also one of a group of private sector banks, which cumulatively only have 25% market share, which have been taking share and we believe will continue to take share from their state-owned peers. So we see them as sitting in an environment with a bunch of sitting ducks, as you were. So the state-owned banks are slow-moving, capital-constrained, and really unable to match what Axis and Yes Bank, which is another one of its peers, are able to do. So we see a story there where bad debts recover from cyclically high levels, and we also see a continuous growth story there. So it's attractive from that perspective, and then if I bring valuation in, it trades at less than 2x book, which for us is quite attractive. Mm.
Sorry, staying with Axis Bank, is it a counter that you've held for a particularly long period of time? I see here it trades at about a 30 PE and it's had a pretty mediocre couple of months, especially when you compare it to the likes of a US Bank of America, for example.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I mentioned there's a bad debt cycle that it's currently running through, and we do see that as short term. So we do expect that to reverse, and if we look out 3-4 years' time, we would try and normalize their bad debts at, a level that we've seen in the past. And we don't believe it should be materially different to that. But yes, the U.S. banks have had very low expectations on them for a long time. I think they've had an advanced amount of pessimism on their prospects. They've been incredibly topical in the news in terms of regulation. So I think they've perhaps outperformed their low expectations, and we're sorry we didn't own one or two of them.
Peter, somewhere where you do differ quite distinctly from your benchmark is in your geographical holdings. So you have 40% in Europe, just under 30% in North America, whereas the MSCI has over 50% in the United States. Is this merely a factor of your bottom-up approach and where you're seeing value at the moment?
That's exactly right. We look at a number of metrics to understand the level of the market. So we wouldn't say we know where the market's going, but I think it would be quite unforgivable to not know where we're at. So if we look at things like the PE, like the Shiller PE, like the Wilshire 5000 to GDP ratio, a number of different metrics, the market looks very expensive, and no more expensive, the most expensive it looks is in the U.S., so it informs where we do our screening, where we're looking for ideas, and that does, we end up having less exposure there by that nature.
And maybe just in closing, any of your big exposures apart from Facebook that might be making you nervous at the moment?
It's interesting. We look at the fund every day, and I'm very happy, and I'm very confident on the prospects of all my holdings. But I think there's two big risks that are going to happen over the next few years, and one of them is monetary policy. So we could see a risk of interest rates tightening far worse than we anticipate. And the second is trade. A lot of our businesses rely on open markets and rely on global supply chains. So that to me is something that keeps me awake. And just on, I guess, one more point of risks is resources, right? So we've seen now a bit of a bottom in oil, and a good steady oil price is, we believe, what the world needs. But if we do see a blow up somewhere on a geographic basis affecting supply, then we could see a spike in price, which wouldn't be good for many of our holdings.
Peter, we have to leave it there, but thanks very much for taking the time to speak to us this evening.
Sure.
And I think it kind of reinforced what you were chatting about in the first half, the risk of trade wars and also monetary policy. Stephen, thanks very much for coming through.
Thank you very much.
That's where we have to leave it for this week. Thanks to Stephen Schultz, Head of Investments and Savings Marketing at Momentum Investments. Also, Peter Hundersmark, he's the co-founder and portfolio manager at Old Mutual Investment Group's Titan Boutique, for their insights. Thanks to you for watching. Same time next week.